This is February 15th, 2015. First of all, congratulations to those of you who made it here this morning, those of you who weren't required to be here and had to brave zero-degree weather, sub-zero, wind chills and blanket of snow, a fresh blanket of snow. And I found my mind turning toward the issue of climate change and other issues that people have taken sides on, even rejecting scientific evidence such as it is. And I'm going to be reading from an article called Why Science is So Hard to Believe. And this is from the Washington Post. It's dated 3 days ago, February 12th, and it's by Joel Achenbach, who is a science reporter at the Washington Post. And it also says here that a version of this essay appears on the cover of National Geographic's March issue. And I'll just start right off. There's a scene in Stanley Kubrick's comic masterpiece, Dr. Strangelove, in which Jack D. Ripper, an American general who's gone rogue and ordered a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union, unspools his paranoid worldview and the explanation for why he drinks, quote, only distilled water or rainwater and only pure grain alcohol. That he unspools this paranoid worldview to Lionel Mandrake, a dizzy with anxiety group captain in the Royal Air Force. So then here's the from the script. Ripper, have you ever heard of a thing called fluoridation? Fluoridation of water? Mandrake, yes, I have heard of that, Jack. Yes, yes. Ripper, well, do you know what it is? Mandrake, no, I don't know what it is, no. Ripper, do you realize that fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous communist plot we have ever had to face? The movie came out in 1964, by which time the health benefits of fluoridation had been thoroughly established, and anti-fluoridation conspiracy theories could be the stuff of comedy. Yet half a century later, fluoridation continues to incite fear and paranoia. In 2013, citizens in Portland, Oregon, one of only a few major American cities that don't fluoridate, blocked a plan by local officials to do so. Opponents didn't like the idea of the government adding chemicals to their water. They claimed that fluoride could be harmful to human health. Actually, fluoride is a natural mineral that, in the weak concentrations used in public drinking water systems, hardens tooth enamel and prevents tooth decay. A cheap and safe way to improve dental health for everyone, rich or poor, conscientious brushers or not. That's the scientific and medical consensus. To which some people in Portland, echoing anti-fluoridation activists around the world, reply, "We don't believe you." We live in an age when all manner of scientific knowledge, from the safety of fluoride and vaccines to the reality of climate change, faces organized and often furious opposition. Empowered by their own sources of information and their own interpretations of research, doubters have declared war on the consensus of experts. There are so many of these controversies these days, you'd think a diabolical agency had put something in the water to make people argumentative. Now, before you come to the conclusion that this is just going to be a denigration of people who are deny the preponderance of scientific evidence. It's more complicated, more subtle than that, and gets into Buddhist psychology. Science doubt has become a pop culture meme. In the recent movie Interstellar, set in a futuristic downtrodden America where NASA has been forced into hiding, school textbooks say the Apollo moon landings were faked. In a sense, this is not surprising. Our lives are permeated by science and technology as never before. For many of us, this new world is wondrous, comfortable, and rich in rewards, but also more complicated and sometimes unnerving. We now face risks we can't easily analyze. We're asked to accept, for example, that it's safe to eat food containing genetically modified organisms, GMOs, because, the experts point out, there's no evidence that it isn't, and no reason to believe that altering genes precisely in a lab is more dangerous than altering them wholesale through traditional breeding. But to some people, the very idea of transferring genes between species conjures up mad scientists running amok. And so, 2 centuries after Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, they talk about Frankenfood. I have to say, for what it's worth, I am wary of GMOs. And in a lot of these things, I think one consideration is, okay, let's say, let's take a chance and sign off on GMOs or other things. What are the potential risks involved? And that's risk is one factor to consider. But let's let him go further here, make his case. The world crackles with real and imaginary hazards, and distinguishing the former from the latter isn't easy. Should we be afraid that the Ebola virus, which is spread only by direct contact with bodily fluids, will mutate into an airborne super plague? The scientific consensus says that's extremely unlikely. No virus has ever been observed to completely change its mode of transmission in humans, and there's zero evidence that the latest strain of Ebola is any different. But Google airborne Ebola, and you'll enter a dystopia where this virus has almost supernatural powers, including the power to kill us all. In this bewildering world, we have to decide what to believe and how to act on that. This is the sort of the bottom line of all this, is how do we act? Not just a belief system, what belief system do we adopt, but how do we act? How do we proceed? In principle, that's what science is for. And then he quotes a Marsha McNutt, a geophysicist who once headed the U.S. Geological Survey and is now editor of Science, the prestigious journal. She says, "Science is not a body of facts. Science is a method for deciding whether what we choose to believe has a basis in the laws of nature or not." I think this is really important to be clear about this. Science is not a body of facts. It's a method for deciding whether what we choose to believe has some grounding in the laws of nature or not. He continues, "The scientific method leads us to truths that are less than self-evident, often mind-blowing, and sometimes hard to swallow. In the early 17th century, when Galileo claimed that the Earth spins on its axis and orbits the sun, he wasn't just rejecting church doctrine. He was asking people to believe something that defied common sense, because it sure looks like the sun's going around the Earth, and you can't feel the Earth spinning. Galileo was put on trial and forced to recant. 2 centuries later, Charles Darwin escaped that fate. But his idea that all life on Earth evolved from a primordial ancestor, and that we humans are distant cousins of apes, whales, and even deep-sea mollusks, is still a big ask for a lot of people. Even when we intellectually accept these precepts of science, we subconsciously cling to our intuitions, what researchers call our naive beliefs. A study by so-and-so, Occidental College, showed that even students with an advanced science education had a hitch in their mental gait when asked to affirm or deny that humans are descended from sea animals and that the Earth goes around the sun. Both truths are counterintuitive. The students, even those who correctly marked true, were slower to answer those questions than questions about whether humans are descended from tree-dwelling creatures, also true but easier to grasp, and whether the moon goes around the Earth, also true but intuitive. Stuhlmann's research indicates that as we become scientifically literate, we repress our naive beliefs but never eliminate them entirely. They nest in our brains, chirping at us as we try to make sense of the world. Most of us do that by relying on personal experience and anecdotes, on stories rather than statistics. We might get a PSA test, that's a prostate test, even though it's no longer generally recommended. But we might get one because it caught a close friend's cancer. And we pay less attention to statistical evidence, painstakingly compiled through multiple studies, showing that the test rarely saves lives but triggers many unnecessary surgeries. Or we hear about a cluster of cancer cases in a town with a hazardous waste dump, and we assume that pollution caused the cancers. Of course, just because two things happen together doesn't mean one caused the other, and just because events are clustered doesn't mean they're not random. Yet we have trouble digesting randomness. Our brains crave pattern and meaning. Well, I would also interject here, in the case of a cluster of cancer cases in a town with a hazardous waste dump, granted, it could be correlation and not causation, but here too, in terms of what you might want to do about that hazardous waste dump, there's a lot at stake if you're wrong. If you think it's just a chance thing or correlation and there's no causation, fine, think that, but there's could be dire consequences if there is causation and not just correlation. That's what I've always, it's left me flabbergasted about people who deny climate change, human-engineered climate change, is that okay? Maybe these are just natural fluctuations that have always been true over the all recorded weather history. But what if not? Do we want to take that risk? Do we want to put our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren in that kind of jeopardy by acting as though it's just a blip, random kind of variation? Even for scientists, the scientific method is a hard discipline. They too are vulnerable to confirmation bias, the tendency to look for and see only evidence that confirms what they already believe. But unlike the rest of us, they submit their ideas to formal peer review before publishing them. Once the results are published, if they're important enough, other scientists will try to reproduce them. And being congenitally skeptical and competitive, will be very happy to announce that they don't hold up. Scientific results are always provisional, susceptible to being overturned by some future experiment or observation. Scientists rarely proclaim an absolute truth or an absolute certainty. Uncertainty is inevitable at the frontiers of knowledge. Again, science is not a body of facts. It's all statistics. It's the likelihood or unlikelihood of one hypothesis, one conclusion or another. And that's what those who deny climate change cling to, is, well, there's no absolute proof. There's no absolute proof. He continues, that provisional quality of science is another thing a lot of people have trouble with. To some climate change skeptics, for example, the fact that a few scientists in the 1970s were worried about the possibility of a coming ice age is enough to discredit what is now the consensus of the world's scientists. And that consensus, he says, is the planet's surface temperature has risen by about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit in the past 130 years, and human actions, including the burning of fossil fuels, are extremely likely to have been the dominant cause since the mid-20th century. So that's the consensus of world scientists. It's clear that organizations funded in part by the fossil fuel industry have deliberately tried to undermine the public's understanding of the scientific consensus by promoting a few skeptics. The news media gives abundant attention to such mavericks, naysayers, professional controversialists, and table thumpers. The media would also have you believe that science is full of shocking discoveries made by lone geniuses. Not so. The boring truth is that science usually advances incrementally through the steady accretion of data and insights gathered by many people over many years. So it has with the consensus on climate change. That's not about to go poof with the next thermometer reading. You know, one of the things that you hear these hysterical deniers of climate change point to is weather like this that we're having, this deep, deep cold we also had last winter. But it's cherry-picked, this kind of thing, because over and over again, you see worldwide, if you broaden the population of the survey to worldwide readings, then yes, we continually are... the planet is warming up with these anomalies, like this bitter cold. Now we get into more of the Dharma. But industry PR, however misleading, isn't enough to explain why so many people reject the scientific consensus on global warming. The, quote, science communication problem, as it's blandly called by the scientists who study it, has yielded abundant new research into how people decide what to believe and why they so often don't accept the expert consensus. It's not that they can't grasp it, according to Dan Kahan of Yale University. In one study, he asked 1,540 Americans, a representative sample, to rate the threat of climate change on a scale of 0 to 10. Then he correlated that with the subject's science literacy. He found that higher literacy was associated with stronger views at both ends of the spectrum. Science literacy promoted polarization on climate, not consensus. According to Kahan, that's because people tend to use scientific knowledge to reinforce their worldviews. Americans fall into two basic camps, Kahan says. Those with a more egalitarian and communitarian mindset are generally suspicious of industry and apt to think it's up to something dangerous that calls for government regulation. They're likely to see the risks of climate change. In contrast, people with a hierarchical and individualistic mindset respect leaders of industry and don't like government interfering in their affairs. They're apt to reject warnings about climate change because they know what accepting them could lead to, some kind of tax or regulation to limit emissions. In the United States, climate change has become a litmus test that identifies you as belonging to one or the other of these two antagonistic tribes. When we argue about it, Kahan says, we're actually arguing about who we are, what our crowd is. We're thinking, people like us believe this, people like that do not believe this. Science appeals to our rational brain, but our beliefs are motivated largely by emotion. And the biggest motivation is remaining tight with our peers. And then he quotes this Marsha McNutt again. We're all in high school. We've never left high school. People still have a need to fit in, and that need to fit in is so strong that local values and local opinions are always trumping science. And they will continue to trump science, especially when there is no clear downside to ignoring science. There it is again. Well, I don't. Everything's going along all right. Okay, we have some big storms in New England and here somewhat. But where's the warming? Meanwhile, the internet makes it easier than ever for science doubters to find their own information and experts. Gone are the days when a small number of powerful institutions, elite universities, encyclopedias, and major news organizations, served as gatekeepers of scientific information. The internet has democratized it, which is a good thing. But along with cable TV, the web has also made it possible to live in a filter bubble that lets in only the information with which you already agree. How to penetrate the bubble? How to convert science skeptics? Throwing more facts at them doesn't help. Liz Neely, who helps train scientists to be better communicators at an organization called Compass, says people need to hear from believers they can trust, who share their fundamental values. She has personal experience with this. Her father is a climate change skeptic and gets most of his information on the issue from conservative media. In exasperation, she finally confronted him. "Do you believe them or me?" She told him she believes the scientists who research climate change and knows many of them personally. She said, "If you think I'm wrong, then you're telling me that you don't trust me." Her father's stance on the issue softened, but it wasn't the facts that did it. If you're a rationalist, there's something a little dispiriting about all this. In Kahan's descriptions of how we decide what to believe, what we decide sometimes sounds almost incidental. Those of us in the science communication business are as tribal as anyone else, he told me. We believe in scientific ideas not because we have truly evaluated all the evidence, but because we feel an affinity for the scientific community. When I mentioned to Kahan that I fully accept evolution, he said, "Believing in evolution is just a description about you. It's not an account of how you reason." And then the author here says, maybe, accept that evolution is real. Biology is incomprehensible without it. There aren't really two sides to all these issues. Climate change is happening. Vaccines save lives. Being right does matter. And the science tribe has a long track record of getting things right in the end. Modern society is built on things it got right. I'm going to now veer off and go to some Buddhist texts to see how this all, with a grounding in Buddhist psychology, all of this would not be particularly surprising, this denial of scientific evidence and this predominance of affiliation, our group identification as a deciding factor on what we believe. One of the basic ways to understand the way we perceive things is what the sort of the theme of the Lankavatara Sutra. This is one of the great Mahayana sutras, Bodhidharma's favorite sutra, they say, which says that everything we perceive is the projection of our own mind. So it's this filter that we call the brain, that really determines how we interpret reality. Each of us has this interpretive mechanism, the mind, and that there's no way to separate things from mind, or our perception of things from mind. There is a passage from the Buddha, by the Buddha, from the time of the Buddha. Here's how it's recorded, the dialogue between the Buddha and that's one of his questioners. The name is Kapitika. He put a question to the Buddha. "Venerable Gotama, there are the ancient holy scriptures of the Brahmins handed down along the line of unbroken oral tradition of texts. With regard to them, Brahmins come to the absolute conclusion, this alone is truth and everything else is false. Now, what does the Venerable Gotama say about this?" The Buddha inquired, "Among Brahmins, is there any one single Brahmin who claims that he personally knows and sees that, quote, this alone is truth and everything else is false?" The young man was frank and said, "No." Buddha, "Then is there any one single teacher or a teacher of teachers of Brahmins back to the seventh generation or even any of those original authors of those scriptures who claims that he knows and he sees this alone is truth and everything else is false?" No. then it is like a line of blind men, each holding on to the preceding one. The first one does not see, the middle one also does not see, the last one also does not see. Thus it seems to me that the state of the Brahmins is like that of a line of blind men. Then the Buddha gave advice of extreme importance to the group of Brahmins. It is not proper for a wise man who maintains truth to come to the conclusion, this alone is truth and everything else is false. Asked by the young Brahmin to explain the idea of maintaining or protecting truth, the Buddha said, a man has a faith. If he says, this is my faith, so far he maintains truth. But by that he cannot proceed to the absolute conclusion, this alone is truth and everything else is false. In other words, one may believe what he likes and he may say, I believe this. So far he respects truth. But because of his belief or faith, he should not say that what he believes is alone the truth and everything else is false. The Buddha says, to be attached to one thing, that is, to a certain view, and to look down upon other things, other views, as inferior, this the wise men call a fetter. Probably everyone who is listening to this talk is educated enough to know that we have unconscious biases. This is becoming more and more backed up by neuroscience, that we, each one of us, has biases that we're not aware of. This is how it is that so many people can claim to have no racial prejudice, and say it honestly, because they're not granting that the bias or the prejudice may be unconscious. So, without trying to make the case for unconscious bias, I'll just go on to the next step. And I'm reading here from a very short article called An Appeal to Our Inner Judge. Learning to Manage Unconscious Biases Can Help Produce Better Decisions. So I'll just skip to near the end. The good news is that while it may not be possible to eliminate bias, there appear to be ways to identify and navigate it. First, recognize and accept that you have biases. That's a big one for a lot of people. It's a quite advanced level of sophistication and evolution, I would say, to accept that you have unconscious biases. And then he says, rather than feel guilty about them, take responsibility for them. Once you accept them, you can begin to limit their impact. To do so, you must develop the capacity to observe yourself in action and to notice when certain people or circumstances serve as triggers. When you meet a job candidate, you may want to stop and ask yourself, what am I already making up about this person before we have even had a chance to speak? The slant of the article is about job interviews and how unconscious biases can creep into our judgment on those. It continues. This, by the way, is by Howard Ross, this little article. He says, it is helpful to begin to practice what I call constructive uncertainty. Learning to slow down decision-making, especially when it affects other people, can help reduce the impact of bias. This can be particularly important when we are in circumstances that make us feel awkward or uncomfortable. So, this is 80% of the challenge of dealing with these things, these controversial issues, is starting from the standpoint that we, well, to put it in Buddhist terms, that our perceptions are really the projections of our own mind. That each one of us, without exception, is bringing this coloration to issues and certainly to people as well, as he says here. If we can just get that far and just pause, have this constructive uncertainty, then this will go a long way to neutralizing the defensiveness that so easily arises in these controversial issues, such as climate change. To put it another way, our senses don't reveal the nature of things. The limitations of our senses deceive us as to the nature of reality. And we're always bringing to our perceptions our projections are largely determined by the habit energy, the mental habit energy, our tendencies to cling to our ideas, our views. And this the habit energy of our projections resides in the what the Buddhism calls the storehouse consciousness. This is sort of the repository of all of our thoughts, our words, and our deeds from time immemorial. So we all develop a certain bent, we're disposed to see things in certain ways based on how we have always tended to see things. That's the habit part of it. And how do we get free from these projections? There's only one way, by becoming aware that our projections are nothing but the mind. There's a line in the Lankavatara Sutra that says, projections don't arise when you do not grasp external objects. External objects, always, when you hear that phrase, external objects, think of thoughts as well. That's part of what we call external objects. Yeah, but still, so what do we can't just... We can't, as beings functioning in the real world, we can't just pretend that we never can know anything. Well, we can. We can say that. We really ultimately don't know anything. But then we can't leave it at that because we are called upon to act or not act. That's a kind of action, too, is to let things go. As they have been. So in the case of climate change, doing nothing, that's a kind of acting, a decision. And that's the important part. It's not what position we take as a belief, but how we act. I'll pick up with this article again. Doubting science also has consequences, as seen in recent weeks with the measles outbreak that began in California. The people who believe that vaccines cause autism, often well-educated and affluent, by the way, are undermining herd immunity to such diseases as whooping cough and measles. The anti-vaccine movement has been going strong since a prestigious British medical journal, The Lancet, published a study in 1998 linking a common vaccine to autism. The journal later retracted the study, which was thoroughly discredited. But the notion of a vaccine-autism connection has been endorsed by celebrities and reinforced through the usual internet filters. And then he says in parentheses, anti-vaccine activist and actress Jenny McCarthy famously said on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and these are her words, the University of Google is where I got my degree from. In the climate debate, the consequences of doubt are likely to be global and enduring. Climate change skeptics in the United States have achieved their fundamental goal of halting legislative action to combat global warming. They haven't had to win the debate on the merits. They've merely had to fog the room enough to keep laws governing greenhouse gas emissions from being enacted. Some environmental activists want scientists to emerge from their ivory towers and get more involved in the policy battles. Any scientist going that route needs to do so carefully, says Liz Neely. That line between science communication and advocacy is very hard to step back from, she says. In the debate over climate change, the central allegation of the skeptics is that the science saying it's real and a serious threat is politically tinged, driven by environmental activism and not hard data. That's not true, and it slanders honest scientists. But the claim becomes more likely to be seen as plausible if scientists go beyond their professional expertise and begin advocating specific policies. It's their very detachment, what you might call the cold-bloodedness of science, that makes science the killer app. It's the way science tells us the truth rather than what we'd like the truth to be. Scientists can be as dogmatic as anyone else, but their dogma is always wilting in the hot glare of new research. In science, it's not a sin to change your mind when the evidence demands it. For some people, the tribe is more important than the truth. For the best scientists, the truth is more important than the tribe. So again and again, it seems we come back to group identification, which is, of course, is what he means by tribe. That once we have identified, once our identity gets involved in this as part of a group, then anything can happen. We throw out our clear-sightedness, our potential to be objective and fair, and our biases settle into the driver's seat, and we're off and running. So all of this, in practical terms, points to not becoming attached to our beliefs, being vigilant as to when our sense of self, and not just the I, but the we, the us, when that is getting involved, when it might be clouding our perceptions of things. And to notice, here's where the mindfulness comes in, to notice when we're getting attached to a particular point of view. A lot of the Buddhist texts refer to views, getting beyond views. And again, we can dispense with views as long as we have a sense of how to respond. with something like climate change, it's not just an abstract, you know, what's your opinion, and that's different from my opinion, but it's really how we, it's about consumer choices for one thing, how we, what we decide to buy and how we decide to dispose of things makes a difference. But as we say in Affirming Faith and Mind, if you're attached to anything, you surely will go far astray. If you would clearly see the truth, discard opinions, pro and con. Sure, discard opinions, but be aware that your choices, consumer and other choices, do have consequences. A couple of final points. Rebirth. Rebirth is a belief system, at the very least, that could collide with science. Rebirth will never be proven or disproven through science. And you don't need to believe in rebirth to practice Zen and come to awakening. But if we conduct our lives assuming that even if we can get away with murder in this life, we'll still need to face the karmic effects of our actions in a future life, we're more likely to uphold the precepts and not cause harm. It's sort of the same with something like climate change. When it comes to living in harmony with the Dharma, we may not even need to weigh the consequences of our actions at all. So, with respect to the scientific evidence confirming climate change, what do we lose by living in accordance with it? And here's what we gain: a lighter footprint. If we conduct our daily lives as if climate change is indeed a looming threat, we'll be contributing less to pollution and living in a more sustainable way. And in doing that, we're coming into greater harmony with the way. So we'll stop now and recite the four vows.